The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 12, 2013. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
So, good morning. Well, it sure looks different from up here. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Cynthia Scott, and I'm a member here at Dharma Field. And I'm also on the board of directors. And I want to offer a special welcome to any newcomers today. It's always good to see newcomers, both because we love to share what we have here at Dharma Field, and also because it reminds us that we're all newcomers all the time. So welcome. And happy Mother's Day. I brought a prop with me today in honor of Mother's Day. It's this coffee mug. It's got water in it. I gave this mug to my mother for Mother's Day when I was 15 years old. That's 43 years ago. And the reason I still have it is because when she died, it was in the heap of her stuff to go to the Goodwill store. But my brother, who's a very tender-hearted soul, saw it sitting there and assumed it was there by mistake, so he went and retrieved it. Well, it wasn't there by mistake. I didn't have any particular sentimental attachment to it, but I didn't want to hurt his feelings. So I took the mug and I put it in my cupboard, forgot about it, until a few months later, I was really missing my mother. You know, with that ache you get when someone you love has died. And I thought of this mug. And I thought, you know, I'm going to brew a pot of coffee and have coffee with my mother. Drink out of that mug. So I did, and it was wonderful. And it was so great that I do it occasionally, usually on a Sunday. And so since today's Mother's Day, I brought my mother along with me. She was also an inveterate cigarette smoker, so if you smell cigarette smoke, that's where it's coming from. When Bev asked me a couple of months ago if I would give the talk today, I was really happy to discover that today is Mother's Day. Because I think Mother's Day is an occasion that is really pregnant with opportunity. I've been waiting weeks to deliver that line. Pregnant with the opportunity to reflect on and maybe to see how we embody awakeness. And I choose that term embody carefully because I do think we literally embody awakeness. And I sometimes wonder if one of the reasons that we have such a hard time accepting and seeing and knowing that we are Buddha is because we're at odds with our bodies. Our very wonderful and perfect bodies. Now, perfect bodies is not a term that we hear very much in this culture. At least not in relationship to people like us. Maybe supermodels or super athletes. But, nonetheless, they are perfect bodies. But the problem is, our bodies in this culture have become ground zero for all sorts of dissatisfaction and discontent and judgment. And they're almost an unrivaled source for longing for something other than what is. I mean, this hardly needs elaboration. As I said, perfect bodies, I would imagine that a lot of us said, well, she's not talking about me. I mean, I weigh too much. My nose isn't right. Name it. It's an endless list. You know, we can color our hair, we can whiten our teeth, we can straighten our teeth, we can get new teeth, we can remove hair, we can add hair, we can replace, I mean, it's endless. It is just endless. And there's nothing exactly wrong with all that. Although I'm kind of revealing my bias here, but really, there's nothing exactly wrong with all that, except that it seems to me it's awfully easy to slip into the mindset that our bodies are a series of problems to be fixed, rather than the place where we wake up. And our bodies are where we wake up. I mean, that's something so obvious that I think we overlook it. And I think this is really important for Zen students to think about, because we engage in such an embodied practice when we sit. I mean, in our sitting, we breathe. We're aware of our breath. And we notice the pain in our legs, and we notice the twitch in our shoulder blades, and the discomfort in our back. And we might notice judgment as well about our lack of flexibility in our bodies. Maybe we'd rather sit on the floor than on a chair, and we judge our bodies because of that. Or maybe we judge the way our belly comes to rest against our pants. And we either learn to sit with all that, or we don't sit. And I know this from my own experience. I started reading and studying Zen Buddhism 30 years ago. Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind was my first book. And my copy has a price tag of $4.99 on it. That's how old it is. So I loved the teachings, but I could never sit, because I wasn't comfortable in my own skin, and because I didn't understand that that is the practice, to sit with that discomfort, to sit with it, and see the emptiness of it. And then you combine that discomfort with all sorts of crazy notions about what meditation is supposed to be, and what meditators look like, and what Zen practitioners are or supposed to be. And you really have a recipe for resisting sitting. And it doesn't take very long, maybe, to get discouraged and to quit. One of the benefits of coming to a community like this is that we get to see, we come in all shapes and sizes and ages and abilities. And we get support for sitting through that awkwardness and that discomfort. And if we're paying attention at all, we get to see that Zen isn't any particular person or thing. It is just this, just the reality embodied in all of us. And we know that it's essential for us to sit. It's where we experience the dynamic workings of reality. And it's where we can experience the lack of separation that our teachers talk about. One of the teachings, one of the body of teachings that has really opened up my practice for me and given me an appreciation of this wisdom that's beyond any sort of intellectual grasping, that I think is embodied, is the perfection of wisdom teachings, Prajnaparamita, also called, happily enough for today, Mother Prajnaparamita, Mother of the Buddhas, Mother of Awakening. I'm grateful to this place and our teachers for lots of things, more than I can list. And at the top of that list is having been exposed to the perfection of wisdom teachings. I think they're beautiful. I think they're poetic. I think they're vast. They're the work and the play of a lifetime. And I also think they're life-changing. I truly believe that. And just to give the perfection of wisdom some context, and I do not even pretend to be teaching them. I've only stuck my little toe into them. They're a body of sutras that came down through the centuries. There are a number of versions that exist. There's, I learned, the very short one-letter sutra, which is the letter A. I think I got that one down. The Heart Sutra, which a lot of us here are familiar with because we recite it at sessions. There's the Diamond Sutra, so-called because it cuts through all illusion. The 8,000 line, the 20,000 line, the 25,000 line, and the 100,000 line Perfection of Wisdom. The 8,000 line Perfection of Wisdom is commonly used in the Mahayana tradition. And I was captivated from the very first time that I heard these teachings. The very first time. And that was at Sashin when we recited the Heart Sutra. And I was blown away. Even though I had no idea what it meant. None. I mean, zip. Zero. Zilch. Clueless. And I still am clueless. I just don't worry about it as much. Because what the Heart Sutra does, what these teachings do, is they stand reality on its head. We had a great discussion this morning in practice period group from, we're reading Suzuki Roshi's book. What is the name of that book? You have to say something. It's not necessarily so. Right. Anyway, there's a line in the reading we had that says, the Buddha tried to save us by destroying common sense. So we talked about what that meant, and I thought of the Heart Sutra, because that's what the Heart Sutra does. And I'll read a bit of it, just a bit of it, for those of you who aren't familiar with it. It's spoken by Avalokiteshvara, who's the Bodhisattva of compassion, and he's speaking with Shariputra, one of the Buddha's most beloved followers. It says, Avalokiteshvara says, O Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness, that which is emptiness form. The same is true of sensations, conceptions, inclinations, perception. O Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They do not increase or decrease. Do not appear or disappear, are not tainted nor pure. Therefore, in emptiness, no form, no sensations, no conceptions, no inclination, no perception, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of eyes and so forth until no realm of mind consciousness. No ignorance and also no extinction of it and so forth until no old age and death and also no extinction of them. Like, what the heck, right? I have a colleague who often says, that's just crazy talk. When she hears something that she doesn't understand, and I can just hear her saying, that's just crazy talk. And it is. It is crazy talk, I suppose. Because the only toehold you can get is to embrace it and not try to understand it. Kind of like a good poem, you know, that kind of coaxes you into not getting caught up on the meaning of any single word, but just wants you to kind of experience the whole of it. The Heart Sutra, I think, points to the really huge task that's before us, which is to see reality as it is, and not as we wish it to be, not as we hope it to be or want it to be, but to just see it as it is. And to do that, we kind of have to dismantle everything that we think we know and cultivate doubt. There's a book in the Dharma Field Library called Mother of the Buddhas, Meditation on the Prajnaparamita Sutra by Lex Hickson. The meditations in here are based on the 8,000-line Heart Sutra, or 8,000-line version of the Perfection of Wisdom. And there's a conversation in here between the Buddha and Shariputra. And I want to read an excerpt of it because I think it speaks to this this awakening power of these teachings. This reading is called Mystic Hymn to the Wisdom Mother. And it's Shariputra speaking. And he's telling the Buddha about Mother Prajnaparamita. And he says, Mother Prajnaparamita is total awakeness. She never substantially creates any limited structure because she experiences none of the tendency of living beings to grasp, project, or conceptualize. Neither does she substantially dismantle or destroy any limited structure, for she encounters no solid limits. She is the perfect wisdom which never comes into being and therefore never goes out of being. She is known as the Great Mother by those spiritually mature beings who dedicate their mind streams to the liberation and full enlightenment of all that lives. She is not marked by fundamental characteristics. The absence of characteristics is her transcendent, mystic motherhood, the radiant blackness of her womb. She is the universal benefactress who presents as a sublime offering to truth the limitless jewel of all Buddha qualities, the miraculous gem which generates the 10 inconceivable powers of a Buddha to elevate living beings into consciousness of their innate Buddha nature. She can never be defeated in any way, on any level. She lovingly protects vulnerable conscious beings who cannot protect themselves, gradually generating in them an unshakable fearlessness and diamond confidence. She is the perfect antidote to the poisonous view which affirms the cycle of birth and death to be a substantial reality. She is the perfect wisdom who gives birthless birth to Buddhas. And through these sublimely awakened ones, it is Mother Prajnaparamita alone who turns the wheel of true teaching. Now that's pretty earthy stuff to be talking about the radiant blackness of Mother Prajnaparamita's womb. But you know, if you set aside the sentimentality of motherhood and Mother's Day, that's what it's about, is birth and generation and the womb. I think of the Sangha as a womb, this intricate ecosystem that gives life to each of us who come in contact with it. And the womb is a good place to investigate the wisdom of embodiment. Consider the belly button, for example. What is the belly button? Well, the belly button is a little ding left on our bodies by our very physical connection to our mother. It's a scar left by the umbilical cord. I'm going to give a little brief biology lesson. I am not a biologist, but this is fascinating to me. The umbilical cord attaches to the placenta, and the placenta is an organ that forms in the mother when pregnancy begins. Some tribal cultures call the placenta little mother or grandmother because of its vital role in nurturing, bringing to life the developing embryo. And then the umbilical cord is a conduit through which blood flows and gives the embryo everything it needs to become a fetus and to be born. What's fascinating to me is that the embryo creates the placenta. The developing child creates the little mother. So who's giving birth to who here? Norm talks frequently about how beings mutually assist one another, and my understanding of that is that It's something that happens, that mutual assistance is something that happens when we just stay out of the way. And I think this is a beautiful example of it. The embryo giving birth to the mother giving birth to the embryo. It speaks to that dynamic, interdependent, creative energy. And the thing is, it's no different outside the womb. You know, we have this idea that birth happens and then there's this separation and the connection ends. It changes maybe, but it doesn't end. Because if you think about your belly button, and who doesn't, really? You can see this really clearly, because if you imagine the umbilical cord, you got to ask how far does it stretch, really? How many generations does it stretch? Where does that umbilical cord end and begin? If you imagine this little bit of an umbilical cord coming out of your belly button, and at the end of it are your parents, you get this nice little triangle between you and your parents. But you can't stop it there. You got to put their parents and their parents and their parents. And pretty soon you got a big V and you just lot of beings to put your arms around that are your ancestors. And then if you add, as you must, if you add all the non-human beings, the plants, the animals, the sunshine, the water, the air, the soil, the insects, that all nurtured your ancestors. You have to ask, where do you begin? Where do you begin? There's no one point there that you can identify as your beginning. You show up as the universe, literally. I think Mother Prajnaparamita asks us to just rest in this very intricate matrix. But we just to rest, just to embody it, just to live it. We tend to migrate into our heads and to grasp at intellectual understandings. Hickson has a really wonderful paragraph in this book that drives home that point. He says, Mother Prajnaparamita gives her compassionate warning to her beloved spiritual children never to thematize, analyze, review, formulate, represent, project, isolate, define, grasp, crystallize, reify, concretize, objectify, conceptualize, or personalize what is, simply because reality is great, profound, ineffable, limitless, boundless, boundaryless, frontierless, divisionless, identityless, infinite, transparent, harmoniously functioning, open, free, elusive, deep, pure, empty, sublime, calmly quiet, at peace, and blissfully awakened. End quote. Couldn't have said it better myself. Grasping so often arises when we become uncomfortable with not being able to explain something, with not knowing, with not being able to set limits and boundaries and definitions. Among the deepest desires of our heart, I think, is the desire for certainty. Or at least that may be the desire that we most frequently act on. And if it doesn't exist, we create it by grasping. There's a Zen story about a student and his teacher that speaks to this. The student was a very diligent guy. He studied for a long time with this teacher. And he practiced with great devotion, but he was full of despair. He would have moments of great clarity and beauty, and then they would cease, as they always do. And then he would become filled with despair, and he would become filled with longing for those moments of beauty and clarity to return. And this cycle went on, and it seemed that every time he had some moments of clarity and beauty, his despair would return with much more ferocity. Well, one day, he went with his teacher to officiate at a funeral. And when he saw the corpse in the coffin, his own despair kind of reared up intensely. And he started thinking maybe there wasn't much of a difference between how he felt and that corpse in the coffin. And he slams his hand down on the coffin and he says, "Teacher, alive or dead? Alive or dead? I remember reading this on a Sunday morning for the first time because I was having coffee with my mother who's been dead for 13 years. And I thought, that is a really good question. Alive or dead? Alive or dead? And the teacher says to him, "I'm not saying. I'm not saying." And this really upsets the student. "Why not?" he says back. And the teacher says, "I'm not saying. I'm not saying." And now the student is really ticked off. And he says, "If you don't tell me, I'm going to hit you." And the teacher says, "You can hit me, but I'm not saying." And so the student decked him. And the teacher's lying there in a heap on the ground. He picks himself up, cleans himself off, dusts himself off, and walks away. And they never saw each other again. Now there's more to this story. If you want to find out how it ends, it's in the book Bring Me the Rhinoceros by John Tarrant, which is also in our library. But what interests me about this portion of the story is the student's response to not having any certainty. How angry he became when his teacher refused to relieve him of his discomfort by offering a pat answer, a neat, defined answer to an unanswerable question, or at least to a question that he had to answer himself. It's what happens, I think, when we insist on certainty. It increases the chance for separation. It speaks to me of the need to become able and willing to just be, just sit with discomfort when we're uncertain of something. And this isn't just with the big questions of life, like what happens when I die, but the little everyday interactions, like when we're talking to someone and we're listening intently and suddenly we start thinking, what am I going to say when that person stops talking? Am I going to say something clever? Am I going to say something stupid? Or we start worrying that maybe we've got something in our teeth. And we start obsessing about ourselves, you know, that we've created that separation. I think Mother Prajnaparamita asks us to inhabit uncertainty. And actually, if you look carefully at the Heart Sutra, it's more like she asks us to rush headlong into uncertainty. And what she gives us that makes it possible to do that is this present moment. Just right here. Just this. Right now. Past thought cannot be remembered. Future thought cannot be grasped. Present thought cannot be held. It's just this, right here. Mother Prajnaparamita teaches nothing if not that. So, back to these perfect bodies of ours. I'm not just saying that. They are perfect. They are perfect if we understand that who we are is the universe showing up. How can they be anything but perfect? They are deeply perfect in this moment. I'm going to close with a reading from a bodhisattva who shows up in a short story by the Irish writer Anne Enright. She's an old woman who cleans a theater for a building. And this is in a short story called What You Want. And she's on her hands and knees scrubbing, and she's thinking. And so this story is her thoughts. And I think she nails it in identifying the suffering that we bring on when we want ourselves to be different than who we are. So she says, she thinks, if I had three wishes, the thing to do is to get three more. Hello, says the angel, says the fairy, says the devil even. What do you want? One, two, three. And I say, well, first off, I'll have three more of those, please. And then you have five to play with, which is two extra because there's always a trick. Like you might say, well, for my first wish, I'd like to have a beautiful body. And Azakazam, there's your beautiful body. There's your beautiful body, says the angel. And when you look down, you're still the same old yolk. And the angel says, well, it is beautiful. The way one bone fits into another and the blood flows and the brain works and all that. And maybe, yeah, in the scheme of things. But no, you say, no. And you blurt out something like, I want a body like Raquel Welch. And of course, she's ancient these days, so all you get is a heap of silicone and arthritis. Or even worse, you ask for a body like Marilyn Monroe, who is actually dead, not to mention rotten, or you ask for the body of a film star, and the angel gives you Marlon Brando. Or you get the actual body of a film star like, say, Nicole Kidman's body, and she sues. And quite rightly, because there she is wandering around in your old sack, and everyone says it's just prosthetic, like that stupid nose she wore. Serve her right. So the third wish, then, has to put it all right. You think about it really hard, and you say nothing for ages. And then very carefully you say, I'd like a body like the one Raquel Welch had in 1 million years B.C. And ta-da, the full thing down to the furry bikini, except it leaves out your face, which, of course, and you're some sort of monster with a dynamite bosom, like those plastic things men wear at stag nights. Or your face does change, because your face is part of your body, of course it is, and your grandchildren don't recognize you, and no one will let you back into your own house, and you end up in a state of semi-prostitution, just trying to get the bus fare back to the place where the angel disappeared into the clear blue sky. The thing to do, I say, is to ask for the three extra wishes first. Then you have enough to put it right. And the way you put it right is to ask for the body you had in the first place. Of course. The same old heap of bones that gets you up on the bus in the morning. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Are there any questions or comments?
I commented on the story about the student and the teacher and the student's frustration as it was increasing. As you say, you know, one thing that finally led the student to deck the teacher was there was no pat answer. But it struck me too that the student was expecting that the teacher had the answer. It was very frustrating that where this person was looking for the answer, there was no answer forthcoming. And that seemed to really increase that frustration.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, it's not necessarily even that the teacher was holding back, that he was looking for an answer where there wasn't one. No other.
That's one of the most heartfelt talks that you've seen here in Dharma Field. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia, for helping me to be even more grateful today for my mother's refusing to answer and telling us later you have to take the initiative to find your own answers.
Mm-hmm.
And for me to be grateful not only for the genetics, but also for these spiritual teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And not buying into the tantrums of a child nudging and wanting this teacher to teach, where by letting you take initiative, you are being taught. The wisdom is so inspiring. So thank you for that gratitude teaching.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Peter.
Can you say something about I also like the fact that Norman talks about mutual assisting and caring beings, but there's some potential ego trips there too. You know, mm-hmm. I'm the carer or the caregiver. Can you just kind of talk a little bit about, not necessarily the pitfalls, but how to be wholehearted about it?
Well, you know, when I first heard Norm talk about beings mutually assisting each other, I assumed it meant that it's when we go out of our way to help someone. And, you know, of course there are times that we do that. But I think there's a deeper way. I mean, if you look at the example I gave, the placenta and the embryo, there's no will involved in that. It's part of the intelligence of life. And it happens unless we intervene in some way, you know, unless we get in the way. And on a human, I mean, on an everyday level, maybe that mutual assistance happens unless we get in the way as well. Like, for instance, you showing up today is mutually assisting me, certainly, everybody in this Sangha, everybody who's here today, mutually assisting each other by showing up, you know. That's actually offering a lot. So I don't know that I can say anything else about that, except that I agree with you that it's something different than the kind of intentional helping out. Not to diminish that. That's important. But there's a dynamic there that's at work that is beyond that. Anything else?
The notion of the embryo giving rise to itself made me think of the Sangha too. Just now thought it's all sort of arising together beyond the idea of separation between embryo and matter. But I really like how you brought up that interconnection. It's hard to find the directionality.
Mm-hmm. Sangha is a huge gift. It's a tremendous gift. It's a tremendous gift. We need to take care of it. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.